Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, and welcome to the second half of Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. I'm your host, Joy Keys. I want to thank you so much for tuning in. You can follow me on Twitter.com/Joy Keys, and you can become a fan on Facebook. Just look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. Also, send me an email. I would love to hear from you. My email address is SaturdaysWithJoyKeys@hotmail.com. I'll be giving away a copy of Noah Stewart's newest album, Noah. It's number one on the classical musical charts in the UK. I just got off the phone with him. You can check out that interview. And so you want to follow at Joy Keys, and you want to become a fan on Facebook. But right now, I will be speaking with a prolific writer and poet, amazing, crossing genres, languages, different countries, dealing with, you know, women's issues, so on and so forth, classism, environmentalism. Her newest book is called A Wedding in Haiti, and she's the author of more than 19 books. You might have heard of How the Barcia Girls Lost Their Accents in the Time of Butterflies, Before We Were Free, Return to the Sender, and so on and so forth. She has been awarded the 2009 F. Scott Fitzgerald Award for Outstanding Achievement in American Literature. She was selected by the USA State Department's Bureau of International Information Programs to be among the 15 most prominent Hispanic Americans in the arts, contributing to the American cultural scene. She currently works with her husband. They've established Alta Gracia, an organic coffee farm and literacy arts center in the Dominican Republic. I'm going to give her a call now to bring her into the conversation, Julia Alvarez. I'll be giving away some of her books, A Wedding in Haiti. So, again, you want to follow at Joy Keys, and you want to become a fan on Facebook. I'll definitely tune in and check out Noah's the interview I did with Noah Stewart. It was a great interview, and you can hear a couple songs from his album. Oh. Hi, Julia Alvarez. This is Joy Keys. We're on the air.
Okay. Great.
Thank,
I just got
thank
in
you.
At 3 o'clock in the morning, so I got up early for our interview, and it got kicked back.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. I'm not sure what happened.
Where are you guys located?
Thank you so much. Well, I'm based in Philadelphia, but people all over the globe can listen. As a matter of fact, we're past 100,000 downloads of the podcast.
Okay, great. I'm going to Philly next week, I think.
Yeah,
not
I
next
hope
week.
To see you there
week
at
after.
The library.
Right, you have this, I guess this year is dedicated to books about Haiti or something like that.
No, I have lots of shows with different artists. I just got off the phone.
No, I'm
in
the library. The library.
Oh, the library, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I heard that one city, they're reading books about Haiti.
Yeah, Esme Sandcat's her book, mm-hmm. One of her books
yes.
also.
Yeah. So,
well, I want to read a little from the book that you just come out with, A Wedding in Haiti, for the audience, just a little bit here.
Okay.
Okay, I'm going to read. For a while, in my half-sleep, I have been hearing a rhythmic sound, not the patter of rain or anything mechanical, a human rhythm. I peek out the door and see one of Charlie's sisters sweeping the dirt yard with a broom made of straw. It hasn't rained in months. The ground is hard and dry, a grayish color. She sweeps away the fallen leaves, smooths out its clumps. By the time she's finished, the yard is tidy, uniform, pale gray, except for one embarrassing darker spot where I, unwilling to walk all the way to the outhouse in the middle of the night, peed just outside the door. I recall a lecture given by Woody Task, author of Slow Money, in which he claimed that there are two kinds of people in this world, those who shit in the drinking water being used and those who don't. I've now added a third kind, people who pee in other people's front yards. I just wanted to read that part because a lot of the book, you deal with a lot of heavy topics and different books, but you also have a very good sense of humor throughout your book, so I thought that was just one of the funnier moments in the book there.
Wow, yeah, that was when you're in the middle of nowhere and it's the middle of the night and there's no lights and you have to hike out to where there's a little outhouse, it seemed like I'm not going all the way back there, and I just slipped outside, not knowing that, of course, it would show the next morning.
Well, one of the things that you
I think any travel, in order for a story to be interesting, it can't just all be in one key. And one of the problems I think with the media coverage of Haiti is that it's all about Haiti as a problem, Haiti the failed state, Haiti the poorest country in the hemisphere. It's just bombarded, and there's no balance, and there's a lot that Haiti is rich in, and Haiti has a lot to teach us, and Haiti has a wonderful, rich culture. And on a journey there are scary moments, challenging moments, moments of conflict, but there's also a lot of humor. There was that moment when we were at the mango stand, and in a 12-hour trip, the only place we found where we could grab something to eat, mangoes. And it's in the middle of nowhere, and there were about a dozen women, and a truck pulls up with a lot of women loaded in the back. And they mostly stopped to look at us, these two white people.
Yeah, it's...
So they look down, and I look up at them, and my friend who knows Creole, I call up, "Oh, angels, send your blessings down on me," and he translates. And they just thought that was the funniest thing. And I burst out laughing. They were laughing. No language. we didn't share a language, and yet we were sharing this wonderful moment of laughter and connection. And they got my humor, and I was delighted that they thought I was funny. And there you go. You know, and that
well,
doesn't get enough.
You mentioned about the language, and that's one of the things that you bring up as different patterns that you have throughout all your books with the issue of language, the power of language, but also that language can be nonverbal, you know, and with your characters.
Oh, absolutely.
Most I was just speaking about how most communication is nonverbal, maybe almost 80%, and you deal with that in this book. Also, when you first meet the young boy, you couldn't speak his language, but somehow you made this connection, and there was a line in the book about how you can't choose like who you're going to fall in love with, like you don't know, and you didn't speak his language, but somehow you made the connection.
Exactly, that there's a, I think it's why stories work. It's why I can read a book written by a Greek centuries and centuries ago, Homer's The Odyssey, or I can read about Tolstoy's characters and understand them, because really the language is translated, and of course the language is beautiful because that's the medium, but the reason it works is because we're all basically the same human critter, and so we understand. And so with Piti, the young boy that I met in the mountains of the Dominican Republic, we made a connection because he had just made a little kite, and I used to make little kites like that when I was a kid in the Dominican Republic. And so, we connected over that. And, as I say in the book, sometimes you just feel this deep pull and connection and love towards another human being who is not in any way, related to you, or it's just a stranger out there, but you feel kinship. And that's what happened with BB.
Yeah, I like the point about the kite, because I remember my father trying to take myself and sometimes my sister out to fly a kite, and that was just like a really, also for me too, when it came to, I was like, oh, I remember that, and we would go to Penn's Landing down here in Philadelphia, or sometimes even in a park to try to fly the kite, and it's a very happy memory. One of the other things that you deal with in the book is the issue of time and how time is different with different cultures, and how you had to kind of chant to yourself to have patience, throughout the trip. Talk to the audience about your experience with time and how Haitians that you encountered were dealing with time when they say, oh, only a couple minutes, or, oh, you could go there, we can get there, it's real close,
Well, because it's not, it's a very different elastic feeling about time. There's a rhythm to the day. There's a rhythm to how things work. And you just ride that rhythm. Whereas, here we were talking about what time you were supposed to call me, and it's 11 or 11. So, we're really on clock time. And each minute is precious, and we've got to pack it in. And we sort of feel like we have to drive the time and you know, get as much done as possible. And they, it's an opposite feeling. Not only in Haiti, but in the DR, I drive my relatives crazy when I go there. You know, if we say 5, I'm there at you know, 5 to 5. And where are you? When they get in at 5:30, they say, Julia, you know, chill. Forget it. You know, ride the rhythm of this moment and the day. And, you know, it's just a very different feeling. So they'd say, oh, it's just a little ways away. And so I learned, you know, those phrases like a little ways away or, you know, the wedding was supposed to start at, I think it was 7:30 originally, then it was 8:30, and then it was 9:30. And, of course, we were worried because we knew we had a 12-hour trip before the border closed that we had to get back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're operating out of that pressure, but it was when it happens, it will happen, you know?
Yeah.
And it's good. I think it's good for me when we go down because I you know, all the things that we try to learn in meditation and yoga classes about, you know, be in the present moment.
Yes.
And they're doing it.
Definitely.
You know, it's embodied in those cultures. Again,
yes.
You know, this is my point, that sometimes those cultures have a lot to teach us, things that we later take workshops or go on retreats on, you know, to try to regain a sense of that sanity.
Balance.
In many ways.
Balance,
and I'm not
yeah.
minimizing the poverty or, you know, the big challenges in Haiti or the DR or any of these poorer countries that, you know, are trying to survive in this world.
But they have some coping mechanisms that we can learn from. And they also one of the things you talk about in this book and also many others is the idea of family and what is family. And I remember in one point of the book, you asked one of the characters, you know, about his family, who his family was. And it was like, everybody's my family, you know, my cousins, my sister, my uncle, my aunt, my grandparents. You know, when you ask an American in general, I mean, I'm making a generalized statement, somebody says their family, and you mention that in a book, is the nuclear family.
I mentioned that one of the people is asked, you know, do you have family? And they talk about, yeah, like you said, uncles and aunts and cousins and godparents. They say, no. I mean family, you know, as we mean it in the USA, you know, wife and kids. And the man says, but that is me.
Mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
they're me. I'm a we, not just an I. And I think that's another really valuable and corrective attitude towards community, that we're not just I's, we're we's, you know. We're
mm-hmm.
a little seed in the necklace of the generations. And when we think about that way, we can't just separate ourselves from them and say, you know, those are the third world nations or those are the people that, you know, I don't have to worry about. We're a we. And it's an attitude we're going to have to adopt more and more. We want to survive on a planet with
the future.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you talk about environmental issues in the book. You mention about the trees and the charcoal. I mean, we're all connected because anytime we make a dent in Mother Earth, you know, whether it's over here or over there, then over here and over there, we feel it. We, you know, it ripples effects. So we cannot forget, so to speak, you know, our brothers and sisters on the planet because we cannot get away from each other. You know, if we dump
yeah.
oil on the side here, it's going to trickle down there. If there's an earthquake over
right.
here, then all the trash comes over there. So, you know,
right.
yes, I agree that, you know, we need to stay connected. Also, last night I want to bring up, I saw Cornel West and Tavis Smiley, and in the book you talk about how Abraham Lincoln, you know, extended a hand to Haiti to recognize them as a country. And it's funny because Cornel West last night brought up Abraham Lincoln, and I was kind of smiling when he said it, you know, as I was thinking, you know, about your book and just his history. How it's so important for us to reach out to others. And you bring that up in this story where so many people were generous to you. Talk to the audience about some of the generous experiences you had on the trip.
Well, it's just what we found out is, you know, I say some of the things that I learned, some of the insights, is that, you know, in our so-called underdeveloped countries, the basic investment plan of the poor is, you save what you have by sharing it. And so if you have some, you share it, and then when you're in need, you find people are stepping forward to help you because you've you once invested in them. And the example I gave is when we were, the last night we were up in the northwest part of Haiti, Moustique, there was a huge downpour. And, you know, downpours down there are not little rainstorms. I mean, the river swelled, and we couldn't get across to get, you know, out of that area. And one of the people we had given a lift to, Willie Wilson, when we were going to the northwest, you know, we gave him a lift, dropped him off with his supplies, and it was going out of our way, and another, you know, another commitment we had on top of the many other things that we had to do. But we did it because, you know, we were the ones with the pickup. And so when we were stuck in a sandbar, along comes Wilson, you know, and he sees us stuck, and he was on his way to do something, but he stopped, stripped down to his underwear so that he could sort of sound the river bottom and tell us which way to drive. So it was, you know, something we didn't even know we would be seeing him again. We had just, you know, given him a lift because
we
needed it. And there he was helping us. And this is what I mean. All along the way, we found that this is the way this culture operates, you know, in terms of community and helping each other. If you have something, you share it. And it is an investment. It's social capital.
Social capital. One of the things you also talk about in the book, the issue of identity, and this is, again, a big theme in many of your books, you know, what is it to be a woman? What is it to be Latina? What is it to be Haitian? What is it to be Dominican? What is it to be American? One of the moments in the book, you're in the trip and you're going to the wedding, and you ask, like, well, how are they going to know you're Haitian? And he's like, they're going to know, you know? And you bring up the history, the unfortunate history between, you know, the battles and the wars, and how they use a specific word for the people to say, and if they said it wrong or incorrectly, then they were killed. How do you balance your identity? Because people try to box you. Some people want you to be Dominican and only do, you know, poetry this way. Some people are like, you're American. Then other people, even in the book, you talk, oh, you're white. I mean, how do you deal with this, you know, identity crisis? Or is it a crisis for you anymore at this point, you know?
It's not anymore. You know, one of the big errors when I came to the United States as an immigrant in the early 1960, was, you know, that we were in the old model of immigration and diaspora in which you were either or. And people still try to do that. You know, you're either Dominican or American. You're either Polish or American. And when you came to the States, the old assimilation model was that the price for becoming an American citizen is you cut off your ties to the past, you learn English, you're an American now. It's either or. And you cut off a part of yourself, your rich heritage, things that you could give and infuse this new culture with. And so, you know, I think that I felt like, you know, I had to choose, Dominican or American. Am I going to be an English speaker or am I going to be a Spanish speaker? Either or. And the older I get, I see that that's not a viable model. And whenever I see anybody trying to box me or anyone else into that, and it happens on both sides. You know, if you're a real Dominican, you do this. You know, if you're with us, you're not with us. And I say, you know, I'm more and more the mentality that I think is important to adopt is I'm a citizen of the world. I'm many people.
Yes.
When I travel to Haiti, I become part of Haiti. You know, this is my family too. So I think that kind of expansive view of what it means to be, you know, as I say, a citizen of the world is the one that I feel really most defines me these days. But, you know, you also have to claim your roots because that's what you've got to bring to the large circle of the human family, you know, your little tribe, your stories, you know, your cuisine, your dances, your music, all of that is what you bring. And that's a wonderful thing to claim. And this is something that, you know, I think it's also important. And part of the problem in the United States many times is that people feel like they don't know what their heritage is. You know, they don't know, they feel like they don't have a story.
They don't have a foundation. Yeah, they don't have a foundation. Right. They feel lost. And I think what you said about a citizen of the world, I mean, knowing your history, accepting the facets of yourself can bring a wholeness. You have to be whole. Otherwise, there's an imbalance. And if you're walking around, you know, trying to not, I guess, accept one part of yourself, it's a blight on yourself. You're cutting yourself short by not allowing all those parts to congeal together, because that will make you.
You're like an air plant. You don't have roots. You know, what are you going to bring to the circle? You know, it's really funny because when I was doing the book, Once Upon a Quinceañera, Coming of Age in the USA, it's a book about. But one of the studies done by the United Nations, you know, they were identifying youth problems around the world, challenges to young people. And, you know, you can imagine in poor countries what those were, education, healthcare, et cetera, et cetera. But they found the first world, the big challenge, the problem was what they identified as right deprivation, R-I-T-E. Mm-hmm. That the kids from, you know, young people from first world developed countries, that there was a poverty of those rituals and those community markers and those you know, those things that really give a young person a sense of self and a sense of connection and a sense of you know, that they're part of something bigger than just, you know, this isolated, lonely I. So it was interesting. Right deprivation. Never heard of it before.
Well, here we are today. Thank you for sharing about that. Let's talk about, we're talking about culture and history, the past, and oral culture is also highlighted in the wedding in Haiti. This is so important. You talk about how information somehow gets, without a phone, no cell phones, you know, potholes is as big as elephants in the road. But somehow people found out, you know, that, you know, so-and-so is there and they're going to be here at this time. You know, the amazing ability of oral culture, this is something that people did not recognize for a long time in terms of history, that oral culture is a valid way of passing information and history and knowledge, you know.
Right. And one of the things in both Haiti and the Dominican Republic that I loved is the wonderful proverbs. You know, it's like little distilled pieces of wisdom that are put out in little phrases. And they're wonderful. You know, they're the eye has no boundary. You can't buy a piece of mother in the market. In other words, that's a wonderful one. And, you know, the one that I use in part in the book, God's pencil has no eraser. They're just wonderful. Two mountains never meet, but two people can. You know, or the phrase that Edwige has used for one of her books, Mountains Beyond Mountains, and also Tracy Kidder in his portrait of Paul Farmer, you know, that the road has mountains beyond mountains. There's always one more challenge. So, you know, and what was interesting to me is that so many of the sayings in Creole also exist in Spanish on the Dominican side, which says to me also that despite the fact that there's been this conflict between the two countries and
they're
this
connected,
history of, that profoundly the people are connected. And it came to the fore after the earthquake, you know, despite this history, when this sister nation was brought down and its capital city was devastated, Dominicans really stepped up to the plate. I was, you know, I wrote an op-ed piece saying, you know, this is our time to really show that, you know, this is our neighbor country and to turn around the history. And I didn't need to write that op-ed. People out of their hearts recognized that this was a moment of need and the conflict was fine. So, you know, clinics established along the border, people doing drives, food drives, supply drives, even the government facilitating the opening of the border so that supplies that couldn't be flown into Haiti could come into the Dominican Republic and be brought across the border by land. It was really.
Well, this is going back to Julie. This is going back to the idea of generosity again, and how important that generosity is in maintaining all of us together. You know that we cannot isolate ourselves with borders, with walls. With security and armed forces, we are still connected because all those things can disappear in a second. And then what? You know, once they disappear, then what? You know. So
I want to thank
you.
Go ahead. Oh, sure.
No, we just have about a minute. You wanted to say something? Go ahead.
Oh, no. I just we're in total agreement. If it could only be the two of us ruling the world.
You know, move over Obama and Romney. Here come Julie Alvarez and Joy Keyes.
Oh, boy. But anyhow.
Well, thank you so much, and I apologize for any confusion this morning, but thank you, and thank you for coming on the show today. I'll be giving away some of your books to the audience, so I encourage them to follow me at Joy Keyes on Twitter and become a fan on Facebook to find out how to win a copy of A Wedding in Haiti. Thank you so much, and I'll see you in about a week here in Philadelphia.
Oh, thank you. Bye-bye, Joy. Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. I just got off the phone with author and poet Julia Alvarez talking about her newest book, A Wedding in Haiti. So you want to follow me at Joy Keyes and become a fan on Facebook so that you can win a copy of the book. Thank you so much, and have a wonderful Saturday.